This is the Medicast, May 4th, 2009.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters.
This is the Medicast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the Podmedic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to this week's episode of the Medicast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Podmedic, and I'd like to welcome everybody to the show this week. If you are a brand new listener to the Medicast, I want to welcome you. Whether you're a student, an EMS provider, already on the street, an EMT, paramedic, an instructor, whoever you are, this is the show for you. Here every week, put out for you, make an appointment. It'll be there, ready to go every Monday morning. This Monday morning's no different. We've got a lot going on. Those of you, I guess we should do our obligatory Ned Beatty squeal like a pig swine flu joke here. If you haven't heard one of those versions, you've probably not been out on the street much this week, but everybody seems to be concerned about the swine flu, being a little humorous about the swine flu, and it's been something that I think is a valuable tool. If nothing else, if it turns out to be nothing more than a little bit of a hype, I think we can still learn a lot from it. And we're going to be talking about that on this particular episode. In the meantime, I want to remind you that you can find links to everything that I'll be talking about in this and every other episode over at the Medicast show notes, and you'll find that at medicast.com/blog, the Medicast blog. You can also just go to medicast.com. You can click the link right there on the page to get to that blog, and you'll find the podcast category there along with other categories for different articles that I post. We put a lot up there, links to different articles, links to other resources, and articles written especially for the Medicast, and you'll find all of that at the Medicast blog. And this is what you need to do. You need to follow up on the general information I present here so that you can apply it to your specific protocols and scope of practice. I'm going to do some real quick discussions of a quick couple of emails I got and a couple of hellos to some listeners that had some exciting news this week. But then we're going to jump into a very special episode. So you want to be sticking around for this. We're going to be talking about swine flu. I know, you're sick of it, right? Well, this is a little different. I got together with my good friend Rick Rosati from the Mitigation Journal podcast, and we are going to talk about some lessons learned. And I know it's not over completely yet, and hopefully it seems like it's dying down, but what are we going to take away from this? What can you, the provider on the street, do with the things you've learned about swine flu, about pandemic, about your own company's infection control response or lack of an infectious disease response? All of that is going to be something you're going to find out here in just a few minutes and in a great conversation that I had with Rick. So stay tuned for that. In the meantime, let's jump on in and talk to some of the listeners and listen to the listener email. Real quick, got an email in from listener Barry, longtime listener and supporter of the show. He sent me an article he wrote a few years back for Fire Engineering Magazine and wanted to touch on some things about tourniquets, and was just commenting on how he enjoyed the episode last week when we talked about tourniquet use and review of some of the National Registry changes for bleeding control in their skills station. So Barry, thanks very much for that. I've looked at the article and I'm going to be maybe featuring some content from that in a future episode or up on the website, and I'll get in touch with you and let you know about that. But, you know, thanks you and everybody else that sends me links and articles and other information. You know, anybody that has an article or something they'd like to just post on the blog, you know, send me a copy of it. Tell me that you want me to post it on the blog. I'll read over it and I'd be happy to put it up there. I'm always looking for contributors to the Medicast and even, you know, contributors to the Medicast blog. So if you have something, even if it's just a couple of paragraphs, I'd be happy to consider it and put it up on the site. And it could be about anything EMS related. I also got an email. Actually, Matt, our good friend, wrote on my Facebook wall that he passed his state intermediate test this morning. This was about 3 or 4 days ago, and I was late getting back to him over at Facebook responding. But you know what, Matt? We are so proud of you. You've been a supporter of the show, contributed here, talking about National Registry testing in the past. And, you know, he just says it's in no small part due to your podcast. Well, I just want to remind all of you that the podcast is here in no small part due to the support of the entire community and all of the listeners out there. So thank you for sharing the podcast with your friends. Thank you for supporting the podcast, for going over and buying stuff at the store to keep us going here, for supporting our advertisers. And Matt, good luck to you. I am looking forward to many years hearing from you as a very successful provider on the street and a continued supporter here of the Medicast. Hey, if you'd like to touch base with me here, send an email or something like that, you can send that in to podmedic@mac.com. You can also always leave comments over at the Medicast website or right on my Facebook wall. You can find me over at Facebook. Just search for Medicast, or you can look for Jamie Davis, the Podmedic, over there, and you'll be able to find me over at Facebook, MySpace, Twitter, and a couple other places. On Twitter, I'm under Podmedic. So, you know, go ahead and friend me or add me as your follower on Twitter or whatever. I'd be happy to hear back from all of you. It's great to have that sense of community that those services provide. Of course, you can also call into the voicemail line, 941-306-3342. That's 941-30-MEDIC. No surprises this week for this week's Link of the Week. This week's Link of the Week is going to be cdc.gov. You know, it's been swine flu fever. Is that a pun? I don't know. Anyway, it's been a swine flu craziness out there. The media has really pumped this thing up. And yet there's some really very real dangers associated with this disease for certain patient populations, and certainly something any medical professional wants to be aware about. Where do you get the best information for that kind of thing? Over at the Centers for Disease Control. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control gives you up-to-date information for what's going on here in the U.S. If you're an international listener of the show, don't worry. They've got links to the World Health Organization that you can link to off there and check out the world outlook for swine flu. And, you know, this is what you need to do. You need to be making a list of these types of trusted resources for you wherever you are, so that you have a place to go to get the best information. So when your patients ask you, your neighbors, your family members ask you about something they're concerned, you know, legitimately have a concern about, you can give them the best answers or the best places to go and get answers. So I want to just put that out there, cdc.gov. They have a newsletter. They have a podcast. I mean, you can get all kinds of information from that site and links to other great information if you can't find it there. So I'm just going to leave that out there as this week's Link of the Week. All right, time to jump into the main segment for this week's episode. It's going to be a combined news and information tip segment, because I think a lot of us have just been inundated with a lot of questions and what are we supposed to do with this swine flu thing, right? And so this is going to be some news. It's also going to be some tips and some thoughts that you can take with you. What have we learned so far about what we need to do regarding swine flu or any other biological infectious event? And this may be mostly over at this point as I record this on May 3rd, Sunday. Seems like things have slowed down and are not as serious as they may have initially appeared, but it doesn't mean we can't learn something from this, or as it moves forward, continue to learn something from it. So without further ado, I'm going to jump into an excellent segment recorded earlier today with Rick Rosati from the Mitigation Journal podcast. You know, this is his thing. This is what his show is all about: preparedness, preparedness, preparedness. And he and I have a great discussion about some of the things we've learned as we've assisted with our agencies moving through the process of what we're supposed to do with this swine flu thing. So we have some list of resources we've got there. You'll find them in the show notes over at my site or at Rick's site at mitigationjournal.com. And I will just move right on in as we pick up our conversation on what we've learned about the swine flu.
Well, Jamie, you know, we're talking about this whole episode we've endured in the nation and indeed around the world, known as this swine flu, or I guess to be more currently correct, we're talking about the 2009 strain of the H1N1 flu virus that seems to have originated in or around Mexico City and spread quite quickly around the globe, falling just short, I guess, of the textbook definition of a pandemic as described by the World Health Organization. And, you know, we're discussing a few things that really we should take home from this. We need to start with the idea of understanding, first of all, that seasonal flu kills as many as 35 to 40,000 people in the United States every single year. That's seasonal flu that we deal with all the time. There's nothing special about that. And most of the people that succumb to flu every year in this country are those people that are in the extremes of age, the very young, the elderly, and those with pre-existing immunocompromised diseases or other health care conditions that are made worse by the flu. What was alarming about the situation in Mexico was that this flu seemed to take by storm otherwise healthy individuals, and those individuals in the age range of, let's say, 20 to 50, I think, were particularly hard hit in the deaths in Mexico, and that was a little concerning to most folks in public health because, as I said, the typical flu affects those that are either very young or very old or indeed immunocompromised. And so this thing starts to spread. And we look at the timing of the event at occurring at a time where many people from around the world, and especially from the United States, find themselves in Mexico for spring break in the Cancun area and vacation spots such as that. And we watch this thing just start to evolve with little or no warning. And many of our pandemic plans that we've gone through are based on having a fairly decent lead time. So here we have this novel virus, or this previously undiscovered virus, show up in Mexico, affect otherwise healthy individuals in usually an unaffected age group, and we have it happen at a time where people are traveling to that area, taking it back to their home location, and it's got some hallmarks to it that were kind of concerning. If you think back to the case studies done on the 1918 Spanish influenza, you know, one of the hallmarks there was that influenza was impacting otherwise healthy adults. You know, and army recruits were succumbing to that disease in less than 24 hours. Otherwise healthy individuals dying from flu. And it was indeed at that time making its way around the country quite rapidly. And some very, very distinct differences today as opposed to 1918 is the way we travel and the speed at which we travel. So, you know, immediately that, when you look at it from an epidemiological standpoint or you look at it from a public health response standpoint, that immediately raises some concerns. You've got a flu that's affecting otherwise healthy people at a time when people are traveling to an area where they're affected, and traveling then back home. That does a couple things for our response. I think it ratchets up our level of response just a little bit, or our level of urgency just a little bit, insofar as we are really expecting to have some type of warning before this type of flu situation or this virus situation hits our shores. And here where we're looking to Asia or Africa even for the next novel virus, such as we saw with SARS in 2003, or indeed with H5N1. We keep a close eye on that. Many of our plans are predicated on that H5N1, by the way. We're looking overseas to Asia and to Africa, and here we are having this virus show up literally in our backyard and make its way directly to us. And I think that lack of warning, that lack of preparation time, took some people off guard. Now, that being said, we don't want to be panicky about this. We don't want to be, you know, overreacting, as many people have now accused a couple of agencies of being. Whether or not this current swine flu or 2009 H1N1 type A influenza turns out to be anything more than an exclamation point on this year's flu season, or if it indeed turns out to be what we could describe as a dress rehearsal for this upcoming year's flu season, it points out a couple very, very needed details in our pandemic response. And first and foremost, Jamie, that some people, some agencies, some areas and municipalities haven't bought into pandemic planning at all. And I'm sure you're familiar with as many areas that have pandemic plans as don't. The other problem we deal with planning for these events is that, you know, they're really untested. we in our modern time have really not been able to truly test our response plans for a pandemic event. And that is doubly troublesome because if they're not tested, certainly we don't know if they're functional and meaningful or not. But it, in a flu situation or viral biologic situation, if you will, there are so many unknowns that are very difficult to plan for. Some of those unknowns would be very helpful in understanding what we're dealing with. In case in point, again, down in Mexico, we don't know how these folks were unfortunately dying from this flu. Were they dying of the flu itself? Were they dying from exacerbation of underlying medical conditions like cardiovascular problems or respiratory problems? Were they dying from secondary viral or bacterial pneumonia infections? Were they dying because they had delayed treatment for whatever reason? They couldn't get to health care. They got inappropriate health care. They were not given access to antivirals. They were misdiagnosed. We don't know the answers to those questions. And that all becomes important when we talk about the spread of the virus and how we're going to react or respond to that particular spread. Now, that being in mind, the World Health Organization has a fairly robust plan for pandemic events. And that's kind of echoed by the CDC. And it's, again, echoed by many state and local public health offices. But it's difficult to test those plans because it's not something we've seen a lot of, thankfully. And our basic experience, and at least in recent times, comes from that SARS epidemic. So it's very difficult on one hand to say that we should stand back and just watch the situation and respond appropriately. And it's a very different thing to start using terms like pandemic or raising the level or the phase of our pandemic response plan like the World Health Organization did. Now, the World Health Organization plan is based on numbers, not numbers of death. So when the World Health Organization started raising its alert, raising its planning phases in the pandemic, you know, we expected to see people dying, and that didn't happen. Well, why didn't that happen? Well, maybe this virus wasn't as virulent as we thought. Maybe this virus wasn't being transmitted person to person as easily as we originally thought. But the warnings and indicators were there, again, in comparison to the 1918 flu and some of the things we've been concerned about with pandemic. I think we've done a very good job in correlating in the public's mind pandemic with avian flu. That might not be the best thing, but you can certainly understand where that draws some media attention and some recognition and perhaps some motivation towards preparation when we do things like that. Now, avian influenza, or highly pathologic avian influenza, carries about a 53% mortality rate. So certainly, that's a big concern. But when we start correlating words like pandemic with mass numbers of dead people, or mass fatalities, and then that doesn't happen, we have to start worrying about whether or not we're crying wolf about a situation. The problem there is, I've discussed on a podcast a couple of times, is that when nothing happens, nothing happens. And nobody wants to pay or plan or designate resources or commit time when nothing is going to happen. And in fact, in this case, as we see in the media attention in the last couple of weeks, or the last couple of days, as this flu situation starts to wind down, is that in fact there's a lot of second guessing going on. Mm-hmm. How bad was this? Mm-hmm. Did we need to react in this way? And again, I think World Health Organization, I think CDC, and the health departments I'm familiar with here in Rochester, and certainly in our Monroe County Department of Health and our New York State Department of Health, I think responded in a very measured and appropriate fashion. Now, in contrast to that, we had a number of emergency response agencies that didn't respond at all, that didn't do any education or prep work for their individuals or their responders, that didn't stockpile personal protective equipment, such as N95 masks or surgical masks. And we had others that did. So we had certainly a dichotomy of preparation going on. And that's concerning as well, because when you think if one agency prepares that they'll be protected, well, that may not be the case if your neighbors haven't prepared. And, you know, the immediate knee-jerk response might be, well, they'll just sink or swim in this time of crisis. Well, that's not quite it. You could sink or swim, but, you know, if you're all in the same ocean together and, you're all tied with the same rope together, and one goes down, they're going to drag the rest of the people with them. So
yeah,
that
I'd like to jump in real quick, Rick, sure. Because I think you made a good point. Because one of the things I've been doing on my blog here, the Medicast Nursing Show blog, and also I wrote an article over at emslive.com about the swine flu with. And what I did was provide links to trusted resources to try to calm some of the, you know, to be able to give people an opportunity to have the resources to answer questions appropriately when asked by a patient or by a family member or by a bystander on the street. But one of the things I was really trying to do was to point out that while there were numbers of deaths in Mexico City, and I'm looking at the CDC H1N1 swine flu page right now as of 11 a.m. this morning, there was still only one recorded death in the United States. That was that toddler in Texas that actually had contracted the disease and was already sick before they came in the United States. And so why is it that we're seeing these other deaths in Mexico City and not here in the United States? And I was quick to point out that as we look at the progression of the pandemics and influenza swarms, or whatever you want to call them, that we've seen starting in 1918, moving forward, we've seen decreasing numbers of deaths with each version. People have gotten sick, but decreasing death rates, primarily because some research has been done that's looked at what may have likely caused the deaths in 1918, and a lot of some of the research I've found at the CDC and I've linked to has talked about the fact that the people have died were likely to have died from a bacterial pneumonia that they got secondary to the flu. In other words, they had started to recover from the influenza, but they had been respiratory system had been beat down and their immune system had been beat down to the point that they became susceptible to rather common bacterial infection that in the time before antibiotics was a death sentence for most people. So what does that mean? Or do we not have anything to worry about? Did our federal government overreact? Did the World Health Organization overreact? Well, not necessarily, because you think about everyone's agency out there. Think about how crowded your ERs are, how you can take a patient to the hospital and you can wait because there just literally are no beds. Imagine if you had, let's say, 5 extra patients a shift per unit. You know, what would it take to tip the scale for you in your service to have complete breakdown of your healthcare system? And so in our modern healthcare system, where we have people that are generally healthier because we have fortified and supplemented food items because of just a general better healthcare system in place than Mexico City. What are we afraid of? Well, we may not see deaths in the initial cases, but if this had really begun to spread, and we're still looking at things, it seems like things have calmed down. We're recording this on Sunday, May 3rd, but you know, what are we going to do if something comes along that while it wouldn't kill the people that initially get the disease, but as it ramps up and infects more and more people, the numbers of people that do need to seek healthcare attention becomes greater than the system can handle. And I know that that's the lesson that I've tried to encourage my region to take away from this and talk to my company and dealt with what should they learn, what should they do. One of the issues we have, we're a rural system. We have 10 N95 masks in our storage closet. We have 10 N95 masks on every ambulance. And we have some surgical masks, but if this had gone on for more than 2 or 3 weeks and there was a run on those items in supply houses, we would be hard-pressed to supplement with what we had if there was going to be difficulty in laying our hands on that stuff. So it talked to us about perhaps we needed to lay in some of our own supplies and not rely on what the county may or may not have available for us. The other thing is, which is more appropriate? Do N95 masks do anything for a viral infection when they're built for larger particulates such as bacteria? And viruses are much smaller than that and conceivably could pass through an N95 mask filtration system. And this is why, and Rick, you've talked about this before as well, you know, really simple droplet precautions seem to be almost as good a protection as anything else, unless you're going to go up to a full filter mask. It is likely that a surgical mask will do for you as well as an N95 mask will, if fitted tightly to the face. And the most important thing is putting one on your patient too. It's actually better if you can keep it in than not let it out into the air at all. But these are some of the lessons I think that I've taken from this is trying to, you know, look at, all right, did we overreact or did we not? I agree with you, Rick. I think that the response by the official agencies was very measured. I think if there was any hysteria or any overreaction, it was by the news media, the 24-hour news engines that had to keep this thing alive because it kept viewers on the screens and paid the bills. And when now they're turning around and saying, well, we overreacted. Well, no one in the government overreacted, in my estimation. There was a clear vision that we needed to make sure we had funding available to be put in place immediately if we needed it, and that's what they did. The CDC responded very quickly. I mean, you go to their website, they already had a lot of information about this on their website. They had a lot of information about influenza on their website, and they've been tracking this. You can see where every single case is, which states. There are 30 states that have confirmed cases of swine flu. You can see how many deaths. There's only the one. And there's another link to the World Health Organization, so you can actually see the worldview. And I think that, you know, this is where we need to call upon our own medical knowledge, whether you're an EMTB, you're a paramedic, you're an instructor, you're a nurse, a doctor, whoever's listening to this, you know, this is where we need to take a leadership role in our communities and make sure that our communities have access to the information they need. And that includes giving our crews access to the information they need to make informed decisions and to provide the public informed decisions. Because I know people got asked about this because I got asked about it. I know other people that were involved in healthcare in any small way got asked, what do you think about the swine flu? And so where do you find those resources? And so I hope that the couple of lessons we took away takeaway from this, because it's not over yet, but is that where do we get the information we need? Do we have a plan in place? And if we don't, where do we get one? And also, you know, do we have the supplies we needed to deal with it if it had gotten worse? And I think that if nothing else, we've gotten an opportunity to examine what we have and improve upon it. And I know you would agree with that, but I just wanted to jump in because I think, you know, some people look at the fact that there have been no deaths in the United States from the United States cases. Is it something we need to worry about? And I think that we need to look at it from the perspective of we overcrowd the ERs with even, you know, four and small ERs like mine, where we only have like 20 beds. You know, you bring in two or three extra patients when it's full above what a normal load is, and it swamps the hospital. And a lot of hospitals in the United States are like that. And so you start spreading that out to every neighboring hospital, and it doesn't take long before they run out of the resources to treat the patients with a relatively treatable disease, at least in the healthy individual, in this case of this swine flu as it appears in this time.
And, you know, that you've said a number of really important points there, Jamie. Just, let's start with the thing about the hospitals and overwhelming the hospitals. Let's understand what I call the ripple effect to these events, whether it's a biological event or a large-scale MCI or whatever the case is in your community. The ripple effect is going to be the fact that your routine calls for service are going to continue to come in. Calls for service from the otherwise well, but the worried individuals or the worried well are going to impact your system as well. And I do think World Health Organization, CDC, some of the medical experts that were on the traditional media outlets were doing a pretty decent job of really, especially that Dr. Besser from the CDC. I'm very impressed with him, by the way. I think they were doing a very good job of telling people up front, if you have this flu, chances are you don't need to go to the hospital. Don't go to the emergency room. Call your doctor. Don't just show up at your doctor's office because we don't want you walking into the waiting room of your doctor's office if you're communicable. Call your doctor. Make special arrangements. Get a telephone consult. Keep these people out of the emergency room. Why? Because the otherwise savable heart attack victim or stroke victim may not get timely care in the emergency department when those calls continue to come in. And that is a universal, I believe, a universal property of these events, that ripple effect. These calls for service are going to come in.
Or worse yet, we get them, we save them from their stroke or their heart attack, and they die from the flu because they had a reduced immune response because they were very, very ill. I mean, you know, people need to think responsibly about their responsibility to their community and their neighbors, and not go into locations, like not go into work when they're sick. Work from home if they can work from home. You know, these are all things that I think people need to keep in mind.
And I think it's important for EMS providers to look in the future, and EMS agencies to look in the future, to do something like what I call to take the E out of EMS and to be prepared to be doing more community health work as EMS responders, rather than the old adage of you call, we haul, that's all, and everybody that calls an ambulance gets taken to the hospital. We've got to get away from that. Eventually, we'll have ambulances that'll just be, you know, orbiting hospitals waiting for an opening, and there won't be any. EMS providers, EMS services have got to start to prepare for and gear up for delivering a certain level of health care in the home and not taking people to the traditional emergency departments.
Yeah, and that comes with, you know, if your protocols don't have a liberal type of refusal policy that can be at least implemented in cases of extreme situations like this, it needs to have one. And this is a perfect example, Rick. You know, you should be able to go into a situation where you think you have a patient with a suspected influenza, and, you know, they're talking to you and they're not in obvious respiratory distress. They've just got a fever and they've got flu symptoms. Well, you know, we should be able to give them some basic advice, you know, hand them a piece of paper from the health department that says, take Tylenol, and, you know, call your family physician either now or in the morning, and please, please, please stay out of public areas, such as the emergency room. And I think that if you had some organizations don't have a refusal policy that allows them to do that. And we need to, you know, you need to put that into place, because we can't use online medical control for that either. If the healthcare system's overburdened, you're not going to get a doc on the line.
Right. And we also have to make provisions in our emergency responses for a point in time in which we make the transition from a standard of a response to a sufficiency of a response. And this is something that we learned out of Hurricane Katrina. When the standard of care can no longer be met, we have to meet a sufficiency of care. And that sufficiency of care is really defined by what we have available, what resources are available to take care of the situation at that time. And that is something that EMS has to evolve. And indeed, I think all emergency services are traditional responders have to evolve into, is being able to make that shift and when it's appropriate to do that. And those are difficult questions to answer, since there's so many dynamics within a biologic situation like a flu epidemic or pandemic, that each one is really, the trigger points for those are going to be different each and every time. But you've got to be cognizant, you've got to be aware that those trigger points are there, and they're going to have to be tailored to your operation. And I think the other thing that you said is so vitally important is good information. Now, if we had, you know, you take the numbers, and I think as we're talking here today, the numbers are 260-some cases around the globe. Does that sound about right to you?
I think so. I'm looking at the CDC site. I haven't brought the World Health Organization site.
Yeah, I looked at the site earlier today, and I think it's like 264 cases. But anyways,
there's 226 confirmed cases in the U.S., so it's got to be a larger number than that. But you know, still, when you talk about the fact that 30 to 40,000 Americans die every year from influenza in general, this is not. At this point in time, and we are more than a week into it, so the people that first showed up with the disease are mostly through it at this point. It seems to have a 5 to 7 day cycle in what I've been able to see. So most of the people that first got it are over it or getting over it. So you know, we should have seen something worse if it was going to happen. At least at the initial cases.
Right. And the point being to your very important point on the the right information to the public. If we had, you know, pointed out that these numbers may sound large today, but understand that in 1957 we had this thing called Asian flu, and Asian flu was responsible for millions of deaths. I think 3 to 4 million deaths around the globe were responsible for Asian flu in 1957, and about 70,000 people here in the United States. Now, the numbers we're dealing with today are just a scratch on the surface of the surface of that particular flu. And so people need to put that in context. We've dealt with something much, much worse than that before, and that is in a day really before 1957, penicillin was still kind of a new thing, let alone antiviral agents. Right. And when you think back to...
Go ahead. Well, sorry, I found the numbers for you, so I thought I'd throw it in since we were talking about it. We have 898 cases as of, looks like, right around noon Eastern time on May 3rd. So 898 confirmed cases in 18 countries confirmed by the World Health Organization.
And so it's reasonable that we could assume then that there's cases that haven't been reported or haven't been confirmed yet. And as we were talking earlier, just the lag in laboratory findings or laboratory confirmations, probably more cases than that. But the point being, in 1957, Asian flu, which, by the way, is now extinct in the wild, so to speak, really ran around the globe, killed a couple million people, maybe as many as 4 million people, and killed 70,000 people in the United States in a time where our healthcare system was very, very different. So people have to be aware of that little piece of history in order to truly comprehend and get their arms around the scope of the situation we're dealing with now. And I do believe your point on communicating that risk and communicating that information is so important, not only in these situations, but in fact in all situations. And if you look at the anthrax attacks of October 2001, what did they do to this country? Well, the anthrax attacks really took emergency responders by storm, and we dressed up in lovely suits and did all kinds of crazy stuff. And those of us that have been studying this material said, wait a minute, we're worried about inhalational anthrax here. Inhalational anthrax is not spread person to person. Inhalational anthrax, if you've been exposed, we can give you some prophylaxis with what I call over-the-counter antibiotics, doxycycline, ciprofloxacin, you know, some really simple stuff. And you're almost guaranteed to recover or not get sick. Yet we had recommendations of duct tape and plastic, conceal yourself in a room. And we were worried about the spread of anthrax when inhalational anthrax didn't go person to person.
Yeah,
so a little bit of information.
And everybody
can go
in the family
way.
Eats pork and beans while they're locked into that sealed room, too.
Exactly. I mean,
somebody wasn't thinking very clearly. And I know you've made that statement before. All right, we're locked in. Now what do? You know, we didn't bring a bucket.
And here we are. Now, interestingly as well, to look at the history of the situation in the mid-70s, and forgive me, I forget whether it was 74, 75, somewhere in there, we had swine flu in this country that erupted with an alarming pattern here in the United States. So there was an Army recruit, as I recall, a military recruit, I don't remember exactly where, came down with what was later diagnosed as swine flu and had some hallmarks similar to the 1918 virus, and that prompted a big vaccination campaign, a big immunization campaign. And although one person had died of flu, the estimations are that the vaccine actually caused 25 deaths. And so the vaccine seems to have killed more people than the flu. Nobody else died from the flu. They had to disband the vaccine program. And we have to get that information out to people when they start screaming about, why isn't there a vaccine for this? Why aren't we doing more? Well, wait a minute. We can't just leap to conclusions because there's so many variables in the virus itself that we just don't clearly understand yet, and that unfortunately that information, no matter where this epicenter comes from, is slow to come out, slow to develop. So we have to rely, in my opinion, we have to rely on those non-pharmacological interventions. The good respiratory etiquette, as you said, putting a mask on the person, putting a mask on yourself. I was having a conversation with a couple firemen and explained it to them this way. You know the little hoses that hang from the ceilings in your fire stations that attach directly to your tailpipes, your vehicles? You know what I'm talking about? So, and they remove the exhaust right at the source. Putting a mask on a person is like hooking up one of those primal vent systems to the person. It really contains the exhaust at the source and decreases the amount of exhaust you're exposed to. So you put a mask on the person, you put your oxygen delivery device on first, and you put a mask over that. You put a mask on yourself. You practice good respiratory etiquette. Instead of sneezing out into the open, you sneeze into your clothing. You sneeze into your elbow if you can. You use a tissue, and then you wash your hands afterwards, practicing good hand hygiene. As you mentioned, waterless cleaners, soap and water, and keeping yourself healthy and practicing appropriate social distancing. And I guess my other point on that is having some level of responsibility for preparedness in the home. Mexico City is a large metropolitan area, huge metropolitan area, I think third or fourth behind New York City in size. They literally closed that city down. Can you imagine what the long-term impact would be on an American city, as we saw out of Hurricane Katrina? The impact would be in the cessation of commerce in that area, what the impact would be on those of us that are used to running up to the corner store, going to the supermarket every 3 days to replenish our food supply when we can't do that anymore. That also has a ripple effect in making small problems in a community much, much larger. So this is an overall all-hazards approach to handling these situations with some very, very common sense things we can all do to keep ourselves safe, not only in flu situations, but in all situations. And there you have the all-hazards approach to managing, in a common sense way, these situations.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, it's a multi-layered approach to this, and I think that that's what most people have gotten from. I know the direction we've gotten from our county government has been, first of all, universal precautions are still in order. And, you know, there's nothing different. If you have a patient with a wet cough that you're picking up, you should consider putting a mask on them anyway. You should consider droplet protection. You should consider all the things that you learn about when you learn about PPE as a brand new EMT in class or paramedic or whoever you are. These are all things we're supposed to, you know, keep on hand. You know, we all put gloves on now, but how many of us regularly wear eye protection? How many of us carry a surgical mask close by and have it on? You know, when's the last time any of us donned a surgical mask in our units? Or put one on a patient. And so these are things that I think, you know, was the very first thing that came out in my direction from my county agency was, you know, personal protective equipment, universal precautions, and hand washing. The things that nothing is new in this. You already know how to do this. These are just, we're going to give you a little more direction on when it's appropriate to use these things. So nothing new. And I think that was, you know, a voice of reason. And it also, the one change that they instituted, and I think it was just something we need to consider, was the thought that, you know, droplet precautions, you need to be, you know, more than 5 or 6 feet away from the patient to keep yourself out of the range where droplets would carry easily that beyond that distance. Assess your patient from a distance if you get a sick person call. If you have a patient with a cough, with a respiratory illness, and determine before you approach them, and how often you just walk right up to the person and you sit down next to them face to face and you start talking to them. They wanted us to not do that, to think about it. And it's a good idea to just keep in mind forever. It's just, you know, you don't want to be taking any of this junk home to your patient, to your family, even if it's just the common cold.
That's right. And in biologic events, and I hesitate to use that term, but it does fit here. We think of biologic events as a terrorist attack. Well, this is a natural biologic event. They lack the big bang. They lack the action item or that thing that calls us to action or raises our awareness. We have to raise our awareness ourselves. We can't wait for there to be cases emerging in some other country or some other state. We have to understand that we're going to deal with flu. We are going to deal with communicable disease. In fact, we do in EMS and in the traditional response groups. And that's my message to EMS agencies of all shapes and sizes, is this is a big part, or should be a big part, of your infection control plan. And how many of us go to agencies where they review their infection control plan once a year because OSHA says you have to, and they don't have a very active infection control program or infection control plan. A good biologic or pandemic, if you will, plan should be a functional annex to your infection control plan or your other emergency contingency plans, and it should be reviewed with people, put into training more than once a year. That is something that is so vital, and you see so many places that don't have a good infection control program or lack good training. And on the topic of training and putting masks on yourself and masks on people, there was a study done, I believe, out of the Colombian Melman Institute in looking at mask appropriateness. And I think, if I can the reference, I'll give you a link for the show notes. They talked about the big debate as to whether or not we should be fit testing for N95 masks. And they found that fit testing was great, but what was even better was practicing with the masks, because if you were fit tested, you were fit tested, but if you didn't know how to put them on right, it didn't matter. And those people that weren't fit tested but practiced putting them on did much better in protecting themselves. So I think that's a very important take-home message, too, is get our hands on these things. We have no problem doing donning and quality drills in the fire service for putting on our structural firefighting gear. Why not doing the same thing for our respiratory PPE for the biological event? And we do very good at doing ACLS skill drills for the EMTs and the paramedics. Why don't we do PPE drills and find out how good we are protecting ourselves so we can treat the patient? And the other thing I want to offer up here, in addition to having a good, robust infection control plan, is to be able to get with your neighbors, take direction from your local health departments and your state health department, and provide a consistent message to your public. I think there's one thing that can sink our ship quicker than anything, is that is when the average citizen calls your station for advice, or knocks on the window of your ambulance while you're sitting on post and asks one of your medics for advice, or asks one of your firefighters for advice, and they don't get a good answer. That erodes public confidence. And in times like this, the emergency responders are looked to for confidence. They are looked to for stability in their organization and in their community. And we've got to be able to really filter out the needed facts and provide a consistent message to the community.
Yeah, and I always like to leave everybody with something they can do. And while we talk about, you know, your infection control plan, yeah, that's an agency thing, and certainly every individual should take the opportunity to review it. And if it's not in a place where you can review it, that's the time to ask your supervisor, your training officer, that where is it? I want to look at it. But I'm going to give you an actionable item that we can all take away from us right now and put into practice with the very next patient and very next time you're on your unit. And here's what it is. I want everybody to get a post-it note or a piece of paper and some tape, and I want you to write hand washing on it and tape it to your dashboard or the center of your steering wheel or wherever you need to put it, that you're going to see it every time you get in the unit. Okay? You can put it where the patients can see it. It's no secret. You know, talk to them about it. You know, I promise you, if you have a patient that's sick all the time and they aren't just a frequent flyer, but they generally, you know, you see them every year in flu season, you know, if you could teach that person to wash their hands, you might pick them up half as much. So that's the thing I want to take everybody out there, individual, to take home with them, is first thing next time they're on the shift is put that piece of paper right in front of them where they can see it, in a post-it note or something like that, and hand washing. And then get better at practicing good hand washing and about talking about hand washing, and teach your kids to hand wash better, and teach your spouse and your friends and your relatives, and make, you know, have fun with it. Be joke about it a little bit, you know, and talk about you know, good hand washing techniques. Get the word out about that and get your own hand washing techniques better, and you'll find you're not going to be as sick as often. You're not going to take stuff home to your family. You're not going to take stuff to your next patient. Wash your units, all those things, but keep your hands clean. And that's the thing I'm going to, you know, finish up with here for me, is that that's just the actionable item for every single individual provider that's listening to this.
I think that's a great idea, and I can't think of a better way to wind up this conversation. I do want to let everybody listening know that I opened up my members-only website because of the influx of emails asking for flu information. I posted all my flu references on that website. There's a link to it off the blog, mitigationjournal.blogspot.com, on the right-hand sidebar. You can grab a link to it there. So if you want to let the Medicast listeners know that that's available for them as well.
Yeah, I'll put a link to that up in my show notes as well, Rick. And, you know, I wrote an article for John Bignell for his site over at emslive.com, 5 things EMS providers need to know about swine flu. And it's just 5 links to credible resources that are updated regularly, like the CDC and the World Health Organization, that you can go to every day and take 5 minutes. It won't take any longer than that. 5 minutes to look at the updates. and you'll know whether it's getting worse, whether it's getting better, whether there's any new treatment ideas out there very quickly and be informed. And that's, like you said, Rick, that's our job. We need to be informed just to be able to answer the question. Even if we just say to somebody, you know what, go to cdc.gov and search for swine flu. It's that simple.
And of course, if you're not, when you're done listening to the Medicast and you're done listening to Mitigation Journal, I rely quite a bit on listening to This Week in Virology. I think those guys are great. Of course, they're a member of the ProMed Network. And it's well worth your time to tune into that podcast as well.
And you know what? That's going to wrap up this segment of the Medicast. And I think that, you know, Rick and I kind of sum things up from our perspective. I'd love to hear back from the rest of you. So you want to make sure you head over and check out the links to some of the things we talked about in the show notes. And also leave some comments over there while you're on that page at the show notes. We'd love to hear back. What are your agencies doing for swine flu? What have they done for swine flu? Does your agency even have an infection control policy or an infectious disease response policy? Be interesting to hear back from some of the listeners on this topic. If you'd rather send me an email, go ahead. You can shoot me an email at podmedic@mac.com. Almost forgot it there for a minute. It's late on Sunday night and trying to get this banged out here. Also, you'll want to make sure that you can also send in a voicemail. So call in the voicemail line. Leave your comments there for everyone to hear. I'll put it up on the show next week or in the coming weeks. It's always great to hear from you. 941-306-3342, 941-30-MEDIC. Can you remember that? Put it in your phones right now, 941-30-MEDIC. Call into the voicemail line. Let me know what you think about this or any other episode of the Medicast. Also, don't forget to find the great resources you'll pick up over at Rick Rosati's site, mitigationjournal.com. There's a link in that in the show notes, but you can find his site over there, pick up his podcast over in iTunes as well, and it's really a great resource for you to just think about preparedness. He's also got some great EMS training tools on his show, on his site. He's a training officer, firefighter, and paramedic in Rochester, New York area, and he is just a fantastic resource for any of you at any level, whether you're brand new, in school, or been on the street for a while. I think you'll enjoy Rick's take on the world and on preparedness, whether it's for the minor event of one patient all the way up to big things like swine flu pandemic. Time to wrap up with some more great music from the PodSafe Music Network at music.podshow.com. This week, I've got a song from a new artist. You haven't heard him here on the show before, but somebody new I found over there by the name of Mike McGill. And this is going to be his song coming up here, Southern California. And just a nice little ditty, nice tune that kind of I enjoyed listening to, and I hope you do as well. There'll be a link in the show notes to the artist page, so if you like what you hear, you can head over and check it out and let Mike know you heard it here on the Medicast. That's it for me. I want to thank you very much for checking out the show, and don't forget you'll be back again here next week. Every Monday morning when you roll out of bed, you'll be able to pick up the Medicast for that week's episode. I'm going to leave you, as I always do, by saying, I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. Don't forget, folks, scene safety, and don't forget that BSI.
Came up to visit some years ago. I fell in love, now wouldn't you know? Was greeted back home with 3 feet of snow. Note to self, it's time to go. Why not become another statistic? I knew back home they'd all go ballistic. Another transplant, let's be realistic. Only I was optimistic. Of Southern California, back east they used to warn ya. They'd say that's the land of the fruits and nuts. All of that talking smack of the wet left coast that's gonna fall off the map. But now that I'm here, I can't go back. So I moved out west, oh what a pity. Found a Southern Cali girl, oh she's so pretty. I thought I'd write this cute little ditty of America's finest city.
in Southern California. Back east they used to warn ya. They'd say that's the land of the fruits and nuts. All of that talking smack of the whack left coast out, everyone's on crack. But now that I'm here, I can't go back. Let's talk about the weather. How can we talk about the weather? Every day is oh so nice here in paradise. Just you and me on the 163, heading to our favorite spot by the sea. I'll stop for coffee and you'll get some tea. Tonight there will be no TV. Another sunset, one for the ages. Another chapter, just turn the pages. Another gorgeous day, well what can I say? I'll never ever move away. From Southern California, back east they used to warn ya. They'd say that's the land of the fruits and nuts. All of that talking smack of the whack left coast that's gonna fall off the map. But now that I'm here,